We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, everyone. Before we start our final Gower Hour of the season, one recording note before we start the show. We recorded, Megan and I, this episode on Tuesday night, and we got done around 9:30 Eastern. Well, shortly thereafter, seismic news in the world of women's basketball. Tara Vanderveer retires after 38 seasons at Stanford. So, as we get the show started, we recorded our show not knowing this news. We talk about it a little bit on the back end. So, just that note, as you listen to the first 50 minutes of the show, wondering why the heck aren't we talking about the second biggest story of the last week after South Carolina? That's why. So, enjoy the show. Season's over. For the first time since 2016, we have an undefeated national champion. South Carolina completes the 38-0 season with the most watched game in college basketball history on the women's side, beat the men's side in TV ratings and the Gamecocks over Iowa to cap a record-setting weekend in Cleveland. Welcome back to the season finale of the Gower Hour presented by the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame. Rob Joyce, Megan Gower, both of us back in the comfort of our homes after a weekend in Cleveland where, Megan, we'll talk about the games and we'll talk about, you know, all the legacies that come with it as Caitlin Clark's career comes to an end, South Carolina. Only one of their college careers came to an end, Camilla Cardoso, as they look to reload next year. We'll talk about UConn. We'll talk about NC State. We'll talk some stuff moving forward, portal, coaching changes. What was your favorite part of the weekend in Cleveland?
I think just seeing everyone. That's always the best part about Final Four weekend is – well, we met in person, but you also just see everyone that you don't necessarily see all season long.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, Megan is a superstar, if you're listening to this. On top of, you know, all the stuff she does. Strolling into the media hotel, and, like, Megan just whips out her key card, and we're just going into this private little, what's it, the M Lounge?
Yeah, the Marriott Club Concierge Lounge.
Yeah, and there's free food, and, like, an hour after, like, I don't even think the net was cut down yet. I'm stuffing my face with loaded fries. Like, great stuff. Who knew? South Carolina, your national champs. We'll go in reverse chronological order. Game, a rematch, you know, the one that all the execs wanted, clearly, based on the TV rating, why they wanted the Gamecocks and the Hawkeyes. Not from Iowa's standpoint, very similar to how they played last year. The difference was South Carolina shot it a little bit better, fell behind 10-0 early, ultimately erased that by halftime, pull away in the second half. Got a little interesting in the fourth quarter, but the Gamecocks, I don't think, were ever truly in doubt that last 4 or 5 minutes. But what were your takeaways? I mean, it's 10-0. Iowa 3 minutes in, it's 21-9, and you know, South Carolina just looked discombobulated. Iowa, as you might have expected, hit their first three, and then that kind of gets things rolling. What were your thoughts early on?
The start of it really looked a lot like last year's championship game, where I think Iowa went up early there too, and you're like, all right, they probably can't sustain this, and then they did sustain it last year. This year, I feel like I wasn't that surprised by the start, just because South Carolina is such a young team, like outside of Kamel Cardoso and, you know, Raven Johnson played a lot in last year's Final Four, but there's just a lot of players on this team that haven't been in that moment, so it's natural to have some nerves coming in, take a few minutes to settle in. And then once they did, they kind of got things rolling. And I think, especially when they already cut into it, but at the end of the first quarter, you're not too worried about the Gamecocks.
If you tuned in to our immediate reaction with Megan, myself, and Calvin Wetzel, that's posted on both our Hoopstats pod feed and the CSN podcast feed, some similar points we'll make across the episode. So apologies if you heard both, but if you missed that one, you know, the impressive thing about South Carolina, of course, is the depth. The hallmark of this now immortal team is ultimately what saved the day early on. I mean, there's no one I can't even think of, not just this year, but hard to think of any teams in past years where you're down 10-0 in the national title game and Dawn Staley goes, you. Four players go in on the bench and not only just change the game, but ultimately, I don't know if save the day is the right word, but obviously you don't want to dig yourself too big a hole against a team like Iowa that can just score like they can.
Yeah, exactly. I think their depth obviously has been the storyline all season long, but really in that moment it was on display, and it was the freshman a lot. I mean, Tessa Johnson, I'm sure we'll talk about more shortly, because she had a fantastic championship game, but Malaysia Fulaili as well, too, went out there, made some important baskets, got some important rebounds, and did what South Carolina needed to get back ahead.
I mean, Fulaili obviously is the, you know, the highlight reel freshman, because she made that play in the opener against Notre Dame, and she comes on and she makes generally 1 to 2 plays in a game that most players just wouldn't even, either they can't try or they wouldn't even consider trying it. But then there's Tessa Johnson, quiet heading into mid-February. I think she only had 4 or 5 double-figure games. She kind of figured it out late SEC tournament. She was really good in their opener against Texas A&M. And then started to get big minutes, important minutes in crunch time of some of these games. You think back to, you know, the Tennessee game in the semifinals. She was out there late in the LSU game. She was out there in the fourth quarter at times before she got ejected with everyone else. Scary to think that, you know, for an undefeated South Carolina team, it's almost like they found something else late in the year. And it's a freshman that everyone's going to have to deal with for 3 more years. And she's a sharpshooter. Like, she was lighting it up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so many pieces of this team are coming back, but in particular, the freshmen that kind of have come on strong Johnson specifically, that have come on strong late in the season and the tournament are going to be back for a whole other season. So this team, really credit, so is obviously a big loss for what she does this season, but they're probably not going to miss much of a beat next year.
Yeah, South Carolina next year brings back, barring the portal and whatnot, everybody except for the Final Four's most outstanding player, Kamel Cardoso. And it's wild when you think about it. Last year, they went from Aaliyah Boston started to Cardoso came off the bench as like this superhuman sixth woman of the year. Then that transitions. Cardoso slides into the starting role. Ashlyn Watkins didn't win sixth woman of the year in the SEC, but similar role. And now Cardoso will leave. Watkins will just slide right in, and they'll bring in the number 2 overall recruit, Joyce Edwards, a 6'3 post player. And if there's one thing you know about Dawn Staley, she's bringing in a post player, they're going to be good. Maybe Sanaya Fagan slides into that role regardless. She's waited her turn. But overall point, Pow Pow is back. Raven Johnson is back. Tessa Johnson's back. Bree Hall is back. Chloe Kitts is back. Everyone is back for South Carolina. There's no reason to think that next year could be any different. And it's wild to think, you know, we said we're never going to see a team threaten UConn's 111-game win streak. And South Carolina probably won't. They are a Caitlin Clark game away last year from doing just that. They're like, what, 110-3 now in the last 3 years?
Yeah, something crazy like that. So, and they're going to be just as good, like we said, next year. So, I mean, there's always, they could lose a game somewhere. They might not threaten that win streak, but they're not going to be far off of it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Forgive me for, I don't, you know, I wasn't alive for the 1986 Texas undefeated team, but every other team, which again, we mentioned on Sunday, has had some sort of transcendent talent when they go undefeated? You think of, you know, the UConn teams had Burton Tarazi, had Tina Charles Maya Moore, had Stewie. That Tennessee team had Holtz Golan Catchings. Baylor had Brittany Griner. The difference with this South Carolina team is obviously they have tons of talent. They didn't have a first-team All-American. They don't have someone who, you know, Cardoso could be a WNBA superstar. Like, we don't know. Time will tell. But with all these other players in these teams, you just knew, oh, this person is probably going to be a Hall of Famer someday. So how do you look at this team? Because they're just different than all of these other nine other programs that finished a year without a loss.
Yeah, I think it's just a complete team. And I think we're maybe seeing some more of that in terms of who's been good this past year. I think there's other teams that, like an NC State that got to the Final Four without kind of that, no full-on superstar. Isaiah James was kind of that superstar for them in the tournament, but that's not like where she has thrived this season. So they've been a complete team, and I think we're seeing just a little bit more of a transition to the importance of having a complete team. And maybe that's the era of the transfer portal and things moving around more and less consistency in who's on a team, that just having the number one star. And I think the depth of the talent pool too, just having the number one star isn't enough necessarily now to win a championship.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's wild to think that two titles in 3 years, there are a few bounces, you know, a loss to Iowa last year in the Final Four. I think they would have beaten LSU in the championship game. Aaliyah Boston misses the bunny against Stanford in 22. They probably beat Arizona the next game. They were the number one team in the country before COVID shut down things in 2020. The last 5 years, they're a pandemic and a couple of bounces of talking. Instead of 2 and 3 years, it could be 3, it could be 4, it could heck, you know, 5 out of 5 isn't so far out of the realm of possibility. They're the new standard bearer. And like, I don't know, you know, I don't think they necessarily needed Sunday to prove that. Maybe they did because so much dominance, you'd like to think they have multiple championships, but certainly no doubt the torch has been passed. It's South Carolina, it's everyone else.
Yeah, agreed. I think we saw it all season and just this weekend firmed it up.
Also firming it up to me, I know, you know, Kim Mulkey has one more title. I don't think anyone else has more titles besides Gino and Pat, then Dawn Staley's 3. I'm ready to put her third best coach in the women's game ever behind Gino and Pat. Obviously, she has time to, you know, if she wins 5 more, that discussion can be discussed further. Right now, she's still a distant third, but I'm ready to put her there. I mean, she's built sustained dominance across generations. Asia Wilson was a freshman a decade ago, and they've been pretty much good ever since. Part what she's done, part projecting a bit for me to put her there, but there's no reason to think come the next 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 years, she's going to add on to this 3.
Yeah, I agree. I think she's, in a shorter amount of time than Kim Mulkey has, like, already, you know, kind of dominated at a different level. And it's just the, like you said, the sustained dominance. They were really good when Asia was around. Then when the freshies came in, they've really just been on top year after year after year. And even that doesn't culminate with a title every year, they're still one of the top teams.
Yeah, 4 straight Final Fours. 7 of 8 they missed in the year, the transition year between Wilson and the freshies. But yeah, they're the preeminent program now in women's college basketball. Other yes. Side of this, the preeminent name in women's college basketball saw her career come to an end with a second consecutive loss for the Iowa Hawkeyes in the national championship game. We'll start with the Hawkeyes as a team, because I feel like it's so easy to get overshadowed by, you know, the enormity of what Caitlin Clark has done, what she has brought to the game. What do you look at this as this era of Iowa basketball? Clark, not just Clark, but Martin and Marshall and all these players who had started, you know, 130 games together all move on.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the best kind of generation of Iowa basketball that there's been. They were obviously good with Megan Gustafson. They made, I think, an Elite Eight with her, and she kind of started that build. But now, I mean, back-to-back Final Fours and is a really impressive achievement. There's not a lot of schools that have been in that state, so, or in that place. So I think that's really impressive. And yeah, a lot of that is Clark, but like the other pieces too should get their recognition. I think a lot of people, myself included, didn't think they could get back there without Sonano this year, and they did. So I think that's impressive.
It did always bother me a little. The narrative seemed to be that Iowa, you know, didn't exist as a program before Caitlin Clark came in. Obviously, never reached these heights. They went to one Final Four with CVIV 30 years ago, but had never, you know, not to this level. But you mentioned they made the Elite Eight in 2019. Megan Gustafson won one of the National Player of the Year awards that year. They make, you know, they've made 15 of the last 16 tournaments. This is a good program that will continue to be good next year. Maybe not a top five team. They're going to be a top 25 team. They have a couple of good recruits coming in. There's rumors that they are the early favorites for a high-profile player with the portal. We'll talk about that in a bit. Near and dear to Megan's heart, this particular player. Now, Caitlin Clark. I know she's not your GOAT. She's not my GOAT. How do you look back now that it's the college part of it is set in stone and finality? I know I asked you this probably 2 months ago and she broke the scoring record. How do you view her legacy?
Yeah, I don't think it changes that much from 2 months ago. Like, yes, they go back to the Final Four. They don't win a championship. But, I mean, I think she's still obviously been huge for the women's game as a whole. The attention that she's drawn. And it's not just her, but she is a big piece of it. Like the ratings number we've seen, she's done a lot for the women's game. And she's also, I mean, the scoring record, two Final Fours, two national or losses in the national championship game. Like, she is one of the best players, especially one of the best offensive players to come through the college game. I'm not going to say she is the best that we've both established that, but like she's in that top tier.
Yeah. If she is your GOAT listener, I think it's valid. The numbers are overwhelming. I respect your choice. I don't have to agree with it, but you know, what am I going to argue with you that she has nearly 4,000 points and 1,100 assists? Part of that certainly timing. She's certainly the biggest blockbuster ever in the women's game. Part of that's timing, right player, right era, right time, where you know TV and ESPN and folks in general are starting to realize, oh, if we give this the distribution and the recognition it deserves, eyeballs will watch. Far more impressive to me, though, whether she's your GOAT or not, there are impossible standards with certain programs in this sport and the pressures that come with it. You know, UConn is fighting an impossible history every year. If you don't win a national championship, if you lose a game, the sky is falling. South Carolina has reached that height. We're going forward. If you don't win the national title, it's a failure of a season. If you lose a game, the sky is falling. Tennessee used to be there, kind of still is. I mean, they just fired a coach for only making a couple Sweet 16s. But those are team standards that, you know, entire rosters feel those pressures, and coaches can try and absorb that like a sponge. Clark basically faced those standards by herself. Like every game, every day, all eyes were on her to go in, put on a show, be the face of the sport while also winning games. You know, you don't ask for that of too many people. And somehow she managed to pretty much meet impossible expectations damn near every time. While also being, I know that people, you know, have thoughts on her antics on the court, off the court by all accounts. Tremendous role model. Signs up for every kid. Takes pictures. Like, that's, I think, more important, her legacy than, is she the greatest of all time? I don't know. I don't think so. But that almost doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think it's a lot for a 22-year-old to carry on their shoulders. It's a lot of attention for someone that young, and she's handled it mostly very, very well. Like you said, she's always signing autographs for kids. There's a lot of little boys and girls you saw on the stands at the Final Four in Caitlin Clark jerseys and Caitlin Clark t-shirts, and she's really taking the time to help out that.
Yeah, I mean, it's foolish. Yes, there are other reasons you watch. It's foolish to not see the correlation between the highest rated NCAA tournament game ever was a second rounder against West Virginia that got broken by an Elite Eight game against LSU, that got broken by an Iowa Final Four game against UConn, that got broken by an Iowa championship game against South Carolina. Like, right. There's a common thread here, and it's number 22.
Exactly.
Now as you move forward, this isn't really geared towards Iowa fans, because they're a good fan base, and they'll be back regardless. But for all those casuals who tuned in solely to watch Caitlin Clark, or if it wasn't Caitlin Clark, solely to watch LSU play, or solely to watch whatever individual, but most of it was Caitlin Clark. Hopefully you like what you saw. Now come back. I don't expect $21 million every year to watch the championship game, but there's no reason to drop back down to the levels that it was before, where the jokes of, oh, no one's watching. Like, so that's the next step here is, can you take that growth that she helped provide and can you build upon it instead of just kind of taking two steps back after she took a step and a half forward?
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of that comes down to how the game is marketed going forward. And it has been a very Caitlin Clark-centric marketing, but hopefully it gets a little broader as we move on. There's a lot of superstars to talk about next year. Paige Beckers, Juju Watkins, Hannah Hidalgo. There's just a lot more than just that. And I think if you spread it more, like, there's more and more people, more and more teams that players are tuning in for, or that people are tuning in for, and that's going to help take the casual fans from, you know, just Caitlin Clark fans to coming back every year.
I will say it is nice that one of my biggest critiques of women's basketball in general is that sometimes, like, we treat them with kid gloves, like they can't handle criticism. And obviously there are lines. I'm talking about strictly, like, irrational on-court fandom that you see in every other sport. Like LeBron, obviously the second or first greatest player of all time. There's always the debate of, oh, he actually isn't good. And, like, it's irrational, but that's sports. And if you talk bad about, you know, all this Diana Taurasi crap that happened over the weekend, like, do you expect players to just come in and go, oh, you're Caitlin Clark in the WNBA? Oh, hail. Like, no, they're competitive.
Right.
They see you and go, oh, like, this is a challenge. I want to show you, rookie, that, you know, I'm up for the challenge. Just because they're women doesn't mean they're not competitors. So I like the kind of irrational discourse that's been happening in kind of my own, like, weird, twisted way, because it's like, this didn't happen 10 years ago, where this is just a mainstream talking point that I hate sports talk radio. Hate every second of it. Hate, like, all these debate shows. But it's good that we're doing it with women's basketball. It's like a normalization almost.
Yeah, agreed. You got covering it like you cover everything else.
Yeah. So that is our... Any other thoughts on the game itself? We talked to Tessa Johnson, South Carolina. You know, Camila Cardoso was the Final Four's most outstanding player. Got hurt in that Final Four game, came back in the second half, and didn't look any worse for wear on Sunday. I mean, South Carolina just kind of did what they do. Like, no one, Johnson had a career high, but no one scored, you know, 30 points. They got contributions all around. Frankly, if they didn't spot Iowa 10-0 lead, it wouldn't have been a blowout, but, you know, the last 36-ish minutes, like, South Carolina just pretty much did what they did. They just happened to be trailing by 10 early on.
Yeah, I think the one thing that got overlooked in the game a little bit was, like, how good Raven Johnson was defensively, because she didn't have a lot of points in the championship. She scored pretty well in the NC State game, but didn't really score anything in them.
I mean, she was 1 of 11 shooting.
Yeah, she shot horribly, to be fair. But defensively, she was really good for them. I think there was a lot of hype about how Nika Mule guarded Caitlin Clark in the UConn-Iowa game, and rightfully so, because she was fantastic. But Raven Johnson did a really good job on her, too.
Yeah, 18 points in the first quarter for Clark, and then 12 the rest of the game. I think she only had one or two buckets in the second and third quarter, and then picked it up a little bit in the fourth, as you might expect.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
South Carolina's your national champion. After Gabe Cox opened up Friday with a win over NC State, one-point game at the half. It looked like we were in for a good one, and then, oh boy, third quarter. Got out of hand real quick.
Yeah, and that's just what South Carolina's done all season, right? Then you might be able to keep it close for two quarters, but you're probably not going to keep it close for four quarters, and that was certainly the case in this one. They came out of the locker room and just they started hitting threes like crazy, and I think especially at the South Carolina team was so good at everything, but when they shot the ball well from three, they're nearly impossible to beat, obviously, as they no one beat them all season. And that's just what happened to NC State. In that third quarter, South Carolina shot the ball well. NC State couldn't make a shot, and very quickly the game went from a one-point game to totally out of hand.
Yeah, South Carolina made five threes in the third quarter. Something we didn't talk about Sunday, they had one fewer three than Iowa, which in that instance, that's a category just Iowa would have had to win to have a better shot. NC State point of view, Isaiah James came out, made her first two threes, continued what she did in Portland. After that, Gamecock shut that valve off real fast. And then I don't think this was ever going to be a good game for Saniya Rivers. This is just a tough matchup. She's a downhill, attack the rim, like guard wing, because she's quick, she has size. Doing that against South Carolina is just, that's a tough matchup for a player like that. Sub 30% shooter from three, so like they're going to let her take as many threes as she wants. She had a tough shooting game. James didn't really do a whole lot after that hot start. Still, there are levels to this. You know, we talked about last week who was disappointed, like Stanford, UCLA, maybe LSU was disappointed. Who's not disappointed for reaching the levels they did, like Oregon State, UConn, NC State's in that latter category, like the Texas category. Spectacular season for getting to the Final Four, regardless of how that third quarter went.
Yeah, agreed. I think just getting to the Final Four was really impressive for this team. And I don't think anyone expected them to win this matchup with South Carolina, or it would have been considered a huge upset had they done that. So still a great season from them, even if, you know, South Carolina was able to kind of blow this one open.
Second Final Four, first since 98. Had been to the Sweet 16 team entering the year, but just two Elite Eights. Then the one Final Four, they finally break through. Unranked in the preseason, finished 31-6. They lose Mimi Collins, River Baldwin. Madison Hayes, I think, has a COVID year. I don't know if she has opted to use it or not. Do you know?
I can't remember. I don't have the draft list open right now. But she would have been on that because they would have still had time. So I guess to be determined.
You're going to lose two, definitely three starters, definitely two, maybe three starters. Zoe Brooks will slide right in, and she came off the bench all year. But they bring back the two big ones, James and Rivers. Wes Moore is one of the underrated coaches in the sport. Maybe that tag goes away now that he's made the Final Four and he can just kind of enter. Like, he's been a phenomenal coach. They win 25-ish plus games every single year, it seems. Won't be taking them for granted next year, for sure. As how do you put a bow on this NC State team going forward now that, like, next year the expectations are going to be higher? There might be that target on the back, but you bring back your two most important players.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good starting place. This team's definitely not going to be unranked to start this season, like they have this coming season, like they were this year. Obviously, we all missed on that. Everyone, I think, we didn't talk about them. They make the Final Four, clearly deserve to be ranked in the preseason, and we'll see them in that top 25 when we get to next year. But I think, I mean, you bring back key pieces in James and Rivers, an experience there. Zoe Brooks, like we said, has had a really solid freshman season. Maybe hasn't gotten so much hype just because of how good this year's freshman class has been, but has still been a really great piece from this freshman class and can be expected to totally get better in her sophomore year too. So they've got a really good core coming back. And then I don't know exactly what they have in coming out of recruits-wise, but also the transfer portal, as we'll talk about in a little bit, has lots of options in it at the moment.
Yeah, and Moore's done a pretty good job in the portal. I mean, Rivers, of course, came from South Carolina. Baldwin came in as a grad transfer this year. So he has some success stories in the portal. So game one, thought it'd be good, turned into a bit of a snoozer in the second half. Not the case in game two on Friday. Iowa 71, UConn 69. All the talk, I'll start off with it, all the talk, the illegal screen. Get it out. Because I, for once, you and I already know. We haven't talked about it, really, but I know you and I will disagree, so give me all of your illegal screen takes.
Yeah, so they call the illegal screen on Aaliyah Edwards with 5 seconds left. UConn's down one, has the ball, basically has a position to get a shot and run down the clock. Olivia Edwards gets called for a moving screen. I agree that it was a moving screen. I just don't think you call that in that moment. It wasn't like an over-the-top foul. Like, she didn't hit anyone in the face. It wasn't overly aggressive. I think it's the type of thing that the refs only call half the time during the game anyway. So why are you calling that in that moment? And, like, to be fair, like, there was a push-off on the other end. They could have called the play before, like, if they were going to call things that tightly down the stretch. So that was my issue with call. Not that it wasn't a foul, just that, like, they hadn't called the game super tightly all game, and then to call that type of foul in that moment.
Yeah, if it's a foul, especially, like, 5 feet in front of the referee, and both of her feet well outside her shoulders, she moved a little bit. I didn't think it was that close. Don't commit the foul. And then it's not even so much that they called it. It's that, one, if they don't call it, what was the play design? Because Paige Beckers would have been stuck in the right corner with Hannah Stolke there and Gabby Marshall, and she'd have been double-teamed with 3 seconds left. And not to say Paige Beckers can't make an off-balance three from the corner, Arike Ogunbowale style. That's a very low percentage shot when you only needed a two to win. So I question, like, what on earth UConn was doing. And then secondly, they call the foul. Great. They foul Caitlin Clark with, what, 3.9 seconds left? She misses a free throw. If you grab the rebound and call timeout, you have 2.5 to 3 seconds down by two with a front court inbound to tie or win the game. And you didn't grab the rebound. That's not Gina Cross's fault. That's Ali Edwards and Ice Brady's fault.
Yeah,
that was
bad. You have to box out on that play. There was enough time left. I think, yeah, you don't expect it. Caitlin Clark is going to miss a free throw on that moment, but you've got to be prepared in case she does, and they should have boxed out and got that rebound, like you said, and given themselves another chance. But instead, they let Iowa easily get the rebound on that play.
And on top of all that, Nika Mule guarded Caitlin Clark as well as anyone in the college game, at least in the last, you know, since Clark's become probably a junior, mm-hmm. has ever guarded her. Mind you, she still finished with 21 points and nearly had a triple-double. But Mule, phenomenal defense. Mm-hmm. And yet, when we talked about this game last week, we said, obviously, Beckers and Clark, two best players on the floor. Ali Edwards is probably third. Well, she wasn't third. That's why mm-hmm. UConn lost, because Hannah Stolke was far better than Aaliyah Edwards. And then Kate Martin, tough. She can play on my team any day. Two biggest buckets of the game in the fourth quarter with that tough little turnaround six-footer. She's so good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Hannah Stolke was fantastic. I feel like she hasn't gotten enough credit for that game, because even all the articles after it came out, even though Clark didn't lead them in scoring, it's still like, Caitlin Clark leads Iowa's national championship game. Hannah Stolke led Iowa to the national championship game. She had 23 points. She had some huge rebounds, some huge defensive plays. She was just absolutely fantastic for them. Like you said, she was clearly the third best player on the floor in that game, and that was the difference maker.
Big sequence early in the fourth. I think it might have been like the start of the fourth. Edwards missed a layup on one end, and Stolke bullied her way up for a layup on the other. I think one of the defining moments of the game that, you know, it's going to get lost in the foul call and the rebound and all that. But UConn season, disappointing end. This is the rare, for UConn at least, overachieving UConn team that didn't win a national title. Because, you know, normally you don't win a national title at UConn. Season's a failure, basically. Mm-hmm. In that UCLA, LSU, Stanford discussion this year. However, this year, I think that's obviously an exception just given the injuries. The fact that UConn was even playing Friday night, had the ball in their hands with 9 seconds left to have a chance to win. Nothing short of remarkable for a Huskies team that they're going to have high expectations next year, assuming everyone's healthy.
Yeah, I think Gino said kind of after the game, like, yeah, they didn't win, but like they had themselves in a position where they could win the game in a game that they basically had no business being in, or something along those lines is what he said. And yeah, I mean, six season-ending injuries, five if you don't want to count the Amari DeBerry one, because how much did that actually impact the rotation? But still, just this team once again was just kind of ravished by injuries. But to get back to this point is just such a testament to Gino as a coach and Paige Beckers as a player that they, I think a lot of people thought they weren't making it back to the Final Four this year, but there they were.
just like NC State. The backcourt's a non-issue at UConn. Beckers is back. Arnold, Shade, back. AZ Fudd will come back. We don't know. Caroline Ducharme, in theory, will come back. But when you're battling as many concussion, neck, head injuries as she has sustained, you just don't know. That's all in the backcourt. And the standard now is building a team to beat South Carolina. Front court, they bring in the top recruit in the country. Sarah Strong over the weekend announced her commitment to UConn. She's a 6'2". She can shoot the three. She can play down low. They still need, I think they need to go portaling in the front court.
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces there, but just a lot of unproven pieces, right? You've got Jana El Alfi, who was really hyped up coming into this season, played great in that U20 World Cup that she got her in, but no. Great player, probably, but coming off an Achilles injury, to expect her to be contributing at the kind of level you need a starting post player on a UConn team to be contributing at right off the bat as a freshman, a redshirt freshman, I think is a tall ask. I thought Ice Brady got better as the season went on, but she's certainly not there at the, you know, Aaliyah Edwards, All-American type level yet. We talked about Sarah Strong. I mean, they'll get Aubrey Griffin back at some point. They'll get Ayanna Patterson back on the wing, but it does feel like they could use someone from the portal in the post.
UConn, everyone used to compare, like, how do you build a roster to beat the Huskies? How do you build a roster to beat South Carolina? You got to have some sort of size down low. That's proven. El Alfi's never played a minute of college basketball. Ice Brady has to make a massive leap. Maybe Sarah Strong is the answer. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, she's the number one recruit. Generally speaking, the hit rate on those is pretty darn good. However, South Carolina brings in the number two recruit. So some holes for the Huskies heading into next year. So that is our Final Four recap from Cleveland. South Carolina, your national champ, not going anywhere. Everyone else trying to catch up and keep up. Meanwhile, at the Final Four on Friday, the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame class of 2024 was introduced at one of the media timeouts on Friday. So don't miss your chance to be part of that history on April 27th, just a few weeks from now. Hall of Fame will be hosting its 25th anniversary induction, honoring players who were there. Simone Augustus, Rita Gayle Easterling, Taj Williams-Franklin, Maya Moore-Irons, Sue Phillips, Viola Palmer, and Rudy Scovel, all for their achievements in women's basketball. Ceremony will take place in Knoxville at the Tennessee Theater, Saturday, April 27th. Sponsorship packages, individual tickets still available. For more information, visit WBHOF.com or call 865-633-9000. Gamecocks win it. We'll talk about next year in a second. Let's go portaling first. Actually, you want to talk portal or you want to talk some of these coaching hires?
Let's talk coaching hires first. Okay. I feel like there's more news there.
Yes. Two notable ones, and then there's a lot of dominoes at the mid-major level, but the two big ones, we'll start in chronological order. Virginia Tech has filled the Kenny Brooks hole with Megan Duffy of Marquette. I know this is a hire that you like.
Yeah, I think Megan Duffy Marquette has been kind of a consistent tournament team in the Big East. They've been just a well-coached team, a strong team, and they beat UConn last year in the regular season. And Megan Duffy is a huge part of that, and I'm excited to see what she can kind of do at a step up in Virginia Tech.
Yeah, just your classic. She started at mid-major level, went up to get a larger job at Marquette, and now she's getting a Power 5 job. Don't need to get into the power discussion in regards to the Big East and basketball, but it's a higher profile job now in Virginia Tech. One of the players who entered the portal chose to stay. I don't remember which one, but there's something there. She has a lot of work to do to rebuild the roster in year one, but there's no reason to think that Virginia Tech won't be good. Maybe next year they take a step back, but they can certainly get back into ACC contention. Then the other one, interesting, on Sunday, this can go a lot of different ways. Marshall's Kim Caldwell is the new head coach at Tennessee. 13 months ago, March of 2023, she was coaching in the Division II Final Four at Glenview State. Got the job at Marshall last year, 30 wins, Sun Belt title. And now she's the head coach of one of the three or four highest profile gigs in the sport. Wild, wild trajectory.
Yeah, this is an interesting hire to me. I think we talked about it last week that, you know, it might be hard for Tennessee to get someone that was in a good position in a Power 5 school, just given what the expectations very clearly are for this Tennessee job if you're firing Kelly Harper. But at the same time, you would have thought that there was maybe options at the mid-major level that have a little bit more experience, a little bit more sustained success at the D1 level that they could have found for this job. And instead they go, like you said, with someone that's very new to D1. Obviously had a good year at Marshall. There's a lot more resources at Tennessee, but I don't know. I feel it's like one of those things that if it works, like it goes over great, but if it crashes and burns, it's a hire that you're going to look at and be like, why?
Yes. If you're unfamiliar, if you didn't watch a whole lot of Marshall women's basketball last year, the Herd made the tournament, lost big to Virginia Tech. She plays a very distinct style. They basically run for 40 minutes. They led the country in possessions per 40 minutes. They were top five in scoring. The defense wasn't always there. How much of that is the players you have at Marshall now, you know, compared to the players you will have at Tennessee, and just the profile of player, the recruiting, you know, the number of stars next to that player's name that you can get at Tennessee. In the SEC, where there's a lot of physicality, you know, you're going up against South Carolina, you're going up against LSU, Ole Miss likes to bruise, and, you know, Georgia likes to bruise with you. A lot of teams that just like to pound it. Tennessee, Kim Caldwell is, in theory, the antithesis of this. So she was asked in her press conference, do you think it can work? And it's kind of a badass answer. She said, if I didn't think it couldn't work, I wouldn't be here. So clearly she's not going to change her style for the SEC. With that, maybe Tennessee lights the world on fire and scores 80 points a game and competes. Maybe it doesn't work. It's fascinating. Now, how much leeway do you think she has? Because that's a drastic change. Like Tennessee, there aren't too many. Like right now, the cupboard's bare. It looks like everyone's staying. Like Jewel Spear announced the day before Harper got fired, she was going to come back. By all accounts, she is staying there. So they have a starting piece. Now it's just a matter of filling it in with Caldwell's profile of player, I guess.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting situation. I don't know. I worry about them filling in the talent because I just now think you have a unproven coach. It's not someone that people are like, I want to sign up to play for this person necessarily. In a program that, yes, has so much history, but like we're talking about players coming into college now that weren't really alive when Tennessee was really good. So how much weight does that carry? I don't think it carries as much as it used to. So I don't know. I'm interested to see what they're able to get in with talent and to move it forward.
Yeah, last national championship, 2008. That was their last trip to the Final Four. Was 2008. Those players were two.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you know, you watch Candace Parker in the WNBA, mm-hmm. and you see Jordan Horston went in the first round last year. Rekia Jackson is going to go in the top three, four picks this season. So, like, obviously, there's recent history. It's just not at the levels that it used to be. Fascinated to see how it works out. And you'd imagine Tennessee is going to go portaling, which transitions us. There are a lot of high-quality players in the portal, and they're pretty much all uncommitted, except, shockingly, Georgia Amore went from Virginia Tech to Kentucky, as did one of the breakout stars, Liz Kitley's backup. Clara Strack came in, was great in the NCAA tournament. She is also off to Lexington, so Kenny Brooks brings a couple. His daughter also entered the portal today with a do not contact tag.
Shocked. I can't imagine where she's
going. Where she's going to go. But a lot of these other players, and it's, if you're looking for a forward, I have bad news for you. There aren't too many. If you're looking for guards, there are guards galore. Do you follow, are you aware of Trilly Donovan, the men's basketball burner account? Well, apparently they're Skim Mulkey now, which I think is him, just he's doing it on the women's side. It looks like Caitlin Chen is off to Stanford. If her mystery Skim Mulkey smoke signals are accurate, but some other high profile names, we won't list all of them here, but Haley Van Lith is in the portal. And then actually we can talk about Van Lith in a second. Lucy Olson, your girl, nation's third leading scorer. Are you sad that she left Villanova? Are you surprised she left Villanova?
A little bummed, but also at the same time, I think this is a Villanova team that, unless they were able to get something big in the portal this year, like, isn't designed for her to be able to, like, compete for beyond, like, a first round of the tournament type situation right now. And if, that's something that she wants, I think it makes sense for her to go somewhere else. So I don't think I'm necessarily surprised, given the season that she had. I mean, what, third leading scorer in the country? She got some All-American honorable mentions. Like, she's going to be highly sought after and can go to a situation where there's, you know, more opportunity to succeed in March and probably also some more money involved.
Yes. What do you make of Haley Van Lith, where, you know, I don't need you to give me a list of schools she should go to, but all American at Louisville, kind of a square peg round hole situation at LSU, never seemed to fit. Now she's in the portal once again. I'm fascinated to see where she goes. And does she, you know, I assume she'll go to a power school. Does she go in where she can kind of slide back into that familiar role where she doesn't have to be the point guard? Someone who clearly she has all the talent in the world. It's a matter of, can she get that stock back up and get a serious look at the next level?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly what this move is about, is some going somewhere where she can elevate her draft stock, which definitely took a hit this season. I agree that she probably goes to a power school. I think the question is, does she try to go to a power school that kind of has an opening at that two guard spot that's going to compete, or is she trying to go to a lower tier power school where she can kind of be the star, similar to where she was a little bit more at Louisville, where, you know, she was the main option on the team.
Some other notable names: Oregon State. Poor Oregon State. Again, we talked about it last week. Nothing of their own doing with the situation they're stuck in with the conference. Talia von Olhoffen is transferred out as a grad transfer. Yesterday, Tamia Gardner announced she was gone. They still have Reagan Beers. They're still going to be good next year, but I think that this could be kind of a sign of what's to come for Oregon State, which is really sad. Deja Kelly left North Carolina. I'm interested to see what the market on her looks like, because she can obviously put up points. She's not overly efficient in an era where efficiency is starting to become more and more important. Some smaller names: Emma Ronsick, one of the big three. Someone from Creighton's returning, right?
All of them are returning except for her, which is, I think, why it's interesting that she's in the portal. But they've announced, I think, Molly Mogensen, Lauren Dunson, and one other starter who I'm forgetting. But those three kind of from that same core of players that have been on this team since that Iowa upset a few years ago are all coming back to Creighton for their fifth years.
And she's not. That's interesting.
Yeah. Though I think her in the portal happened before that announcement, so maybe that changes something. I don't know.
Yes, just because you enter the portal, we should clarify if you're unfamiliar, doesn't mean you can't return to the school that you're leaving. Now, obviously, relationships, like if you go into the portal and burn a bridge versus, hey, I just want to test the waters, whatever, every situation is different. But you are allowed to go back to the school that you were originally playing at. Kaylin Gilbert left Arizona. She is a double-figure scorer. Oregon lost its top two players, Grace Van Sloot and Chance Gray, a couple of big profile recruits a couple years ago. Charlize Ledger-Walker, Washington State star who blew out her knee in January, she's off to the portal. Today, Layla Felia, all Big Ten player at Michigan, is gone. And then these are all guards, or, you know, not true forwards. If you're looking for a post player, there's really only two. Sailor Poffenbarger, Arkansas. She's not a big, bulky forward, but she averaged double-double this year. And then, interesting one, Janiyah Barker was a top five recruit a couple years ago. She's leaving Texas A&M. Does have allegedly a do not contact designation, which means she knows where she's going. Interesting. But any of these names stick out to you more than the others? I mean, there's just, this is the new normal. Every year we're going to have, a dozen or 15 names. It's like, oh, this is an all conference caliber player that is moving.
Yeah, I think like Charlize Ledger-Walker definitely stands out as someone that, when she returns from that knee injury, could be a really huge piece somewhere. And you're talking about a Washington State that looked very, very firmly in the field, you know, six, seven seed type territory, and then without her, kind of fell out. It's a huge difference maker on that team. And I think another one that's probably the unfortunate result of all this conference realignment, but I think she could be a huge pickup somewhere. So that stands out to me. Obviously, Janiyah Barker is, I think, probably, other than Haley Van Lith, maybe the biggest name in here right now. And I guess Deja Kelly too, but I think in terms of players that can make a big impact somewhere, Jahnia Barker is really hard, really high on that list.
I don't know if this counts as kind of an under the radar one, because she was a 5-star recruit and a McDonald's All-American last year, but Talia Scott would have led the SEC in scoring had she played enough games to qualify. She transferred from Arkansas. She got injured and then had what was only described as a serious family situation, and she basically missed the last 6 weeks of the year. She's from Florida. I don't know if that serious family situation means that's the part of the country she's looking in, but she averaged 22 a game as a 5'9 freshman in the SEC. Wherever she goes, she's going to fill it up for somebody. So that's one of the names that maybe, you know, if you're looking at the rankings of transfers, isn't going to be at the top of your list, but she might be one of the most impactful ones going forward wherever she chooses to go. So that's, I don't like the portal. Well, I like that players can use the portal. It's so overwhelming that it's like, I can't go too far into it. There's 1,300 names in there. It's just, so yeah, when I say I don't like the portal, it's, I don't like that I have to like eventually draw a line somewhere. Like, where do I stop with the portal? On our little Google Doc, I have like 15 names. I could have added 100 more. But you know what? Eventually, I just had to stop. So that brings us, as we wrap up the show for this season, looking on to next year. All these names are still in the portal, so this can change, and it will change. Do you have an early list? It doesn't have to be five per se, but list of teams that we'll see in Tampa Bay next year. I would imagine I could probably guess who's number one on that list.
Yeah, I think that one's pretty easy, and it's South Carolina. Like we said, you lose Kamala Cardoso for bringing back, barring anyone entering the portal, everyone else pretty much. So they're going to be right back there as, I think, preseason number one heavy favorites going into next year.
Who else is trying to topple the Gamecocks and realistically in there? I mean, I have a couple of names, but I'm interested to hear yours.
Yeah, I think you look at, I mean, Notre Dame is a team to be very excited about next year, where you've got Hannah Hidalgo coming back and then Olivia Miles coming off that injury along with Sonia Citron, going to be one of the best backcourts in the country. UConn, another team that if AZ Flood is healthy with the freshmen they had this year, and Paige Becker is going to be one of the best backcourts in the country. USC, you got Juju Watkins and the top recruiting class. Then Rhea Marshall coming back, so another team that's, I think, probably going to be right there. Texas.
Also, yeah, I was going to say, I'll throw Texas into that mix, too. Rory Harmon will be back with Maddie Booker and Aaliyah Moore.
Yeah, UCLA, too. Like, you lose Charisma Osborne, but you bring back, you know, Betts, Kiki Rice, all of that class. So another team that there is going to be really good, too. I think Angela Jajalik says she's coming back, too, so I think they're not losing too much other than Osborne, which is a big loss, but they're still bringing back a lot of pieces.
And I didn't write them down, but I forgot LSU.
Yeah.
There were like three things that happened. We recorded last Wednesday morning by like 2 p.m. Wednesday, like three of the things we talked about. Oh, this hasn't happened yet happened, including Angel Reese announcing she's going to the WNBA, announcing it in Vogue. That was kind of badass. But LSU will still be good. Flauje Johnson butted into, you know, I think she found another level in the tournament. I would expect her to be All-American type player next year. Michaela Williams was a really good freshman. In a lot of years, she would have won Freshman of the Year. It just so happened that she went up against Juju and Hidalgo. And then, who am I missing from LSU?
Anissa Morrow's back.
Yeah, Anissa Morrow. Double-double machine. So that core in LSU, they weren't overly deep. They lost one of their highly touted freshmen who didn't play a whole lot this year to the portal today, but Kim Mulkey with three really good players. They're going to be really good. As we put a bow on this season, thank you to our presenting sponsor, the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame. Again, April 27th, head down. There's some, you know, some of the biggest names in women's college basketball history being honored. The growth this year, thank you to those who listened on either feed, both feeds. We made some new fans along the way. If you look at Megan's mentions, she, you know, we made it because she has haters every time she tweets. Is that pretty much like it? That's the standard, right? It's either you tweet and it's either nudes in bio or, you know, a troll.
Someone angry. Yeah. One of the two.
Megan, what we got in the summer plans?
A lot of traveling, weddings. I'm heading to Hawaii in like just over a week. So very excited about that. France for the Olympics. So lots of stuff coming.
I know you're a big U.S. Women's National Team fan, what else are we checking out the Olympics? I mean, it's got to be like overwhelming, right?
Yeah, I am going to some 3-on-3 basketball, so I'm excited for that. And then also some beach volleyball, too.
For some reason, I had in my head a Winter Olympics, even though it's in June and it's the summer. When have they announced 3-on-3 rosters? When have they announced any roster?
That's a good question. I honestly don't know. Sometime before July, end of July.
Fair enough. Well, Megan, enjoy the summer. Enjoy the travel. To parler français.
I don't speak any French, so I'm going to have to study up on a little bit.
Je parle français pour cette année en université. And clearly, I don't remember a single thing. Megan, good stuff all year. You're a stud. First year bracketology. You nailed it. Hopefully, we'll do it again next year.
Yes.
Thank you, everyone. South Carolina International Champs. This has been the Gower Hour presented by the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame. Just kidding. We're not quite done yet because, as we mentioned at the very, very top of the show, Megan and I finished recording the episode you just heard around 9:30 Eastern time last night. Well, shortly thereafter, Stanford dropped a seismic bomb on the college basketball world. The winningest coach in college basketball history, men's, women's, doesn't matter. Tara Vanderveer has retired after 38 seasons as the head coach out on the farm. Obviously, goes without saying, a legendary career, 38 years with the Cardinal. Before that, Ohio State. Before that, Idaho, when the Vandals were in Division II. 1,216 career victories, three national titles, 1990, 1992, and then again 29 years later in 2021. 14 Final Fours. She was the head coach of one of the most impactful women's teams of all time, the 1996 gold medal winning U.S. Olympic team, Hall of Fame class of 2011. The accolades can go on. And it looks like Kate Pay, a former Stanford player, has been a longtime assistant on staff in Palo Alto, is set to take over. They said pending negotiations and the official release. You would imagine most of that is technicalities and small details. No reason to expect that wouldn't get done. In terms of Tara's legacy, when people say pioneer of something, well, in women's basketball, Vanderveer, one of the true pioneers of the sport, a player in the 1970s in the AIAW days, pre-NCAA. She graduated, didn't really know what to do, coached her sister's team, got the coaching bug, and the rest is kind of history. She was brought on as the JV coach, an assistant for the varsity team at Ohio State in the late 70s once her playing days ended. She got her master's after planning on going to law school. Seems like she made the right choice. Again, Division II at Idaho was her first job. Imagine the resources available in 1978 to the women's basketball team at a Division II school. After that, back to Ohio State as the head coach of the varsity team for 6 years, 1980 to 1985, and then on to Stanford. And, well, you know the rest. As within a couple of years, she had Stanford going from sub-500 season, playing in front of literal hundreds of people, to the power that you know it as today. With Tara, always about the betterment of the players, the betterment of the sport. Never made it about herself, mentored other coaches, even those whose ultimate goal was to try and beat her. It didn't matter. If it helped grow the game, her door, her phone, always open for you to call, walk through. Empowered her players, did it while balancing. Obviously, you win 1,200 games. You don't do it without a fiery, competitive attitude, even though there were others who may have expressed it more loudly. Again, never really drew headlines about herself. It was always about how can you grow the game? How can her team get better to win championships? Now, coaches today obviously offered far more resources. Now, even if the commitment everywhere still isn't quite where it needs to be in the women's game, obviously no comparison to when Tara started, when she played, when she was the JV coach at Ohio State. She's one of the few remaining bridges to those original, again, AIAW, early NCAA days. You know, Father Time continues on. The people who were there and are still around for that, dwindling a little bit. Of course, we lost Pat Summitt. Steve Vivian Stringer is retired. Sylvia Hatchell is left. Jody Conrad is left. All these legendary figures who put the games on their backs to grow it into what it has become today are starting to retire out. Tara is very much among that group. There are still some hanging around. Kim Mulkey, of course, was a player in the early 80s. Lisa Bluter was a player in the 70s. Just a couple of examples. There's still enough out there. But few had the seismic, titanic impact of Tara Vanderveer. So where does Stanford go from here? Obviously not direct comparison, but the parallel most will make is Tennessee when Pat Summitt left. And the Lady Vols, their struggles, if you want to call them that, have been well documented. They have not reached the heights that they reached under Pat Summitt. Impossible shoes to fill. That's probably the closest parallel, but Stanford provides different challenges than what the Lady Vols have faced in the decade or so that Pat Summitt has not been there. For starters, obviously the academic requirements to get into Stanford are a challenge that's never going to go away given the academic standing of that university. And now a new challenge, which you'll wonder, did it impact this decision? The Cardinal move to the ACC next year. That is a lot of 3,000-mile plane trips. A lot of 3,000-mile plane trips. Cameron Brink referenced it over the weekend on the Final Four coverage that that was a factor, not the factor, but a factor in her decision to not use her COVID year and to go to the WNBA. You'll wonder how much of an impact did that have on Coach Vanderveer, who just turned 70, going, you know what? Flying across the country and being gone for a week at a time, 5 to 6 times a year, might not be worth it. So Kate Pay now has to try to fill the shoes of her mentor, of a Hall of Fame coach, one of the 3 to 4 best coaches in the history of the sport. She has to battle the difficult requirements that go academically. She's used to that. She's been on staff for nearly 2 decades, so she knows about that. However, now this new uncharted territory of trying to do those two things while you're a first-time head coach, while doing it, fighting a lot of logistical things that are completely out of their control. Stanford made a decision to go to the ACC, and now Kate Pay and the rest of the coaching staff, just like they will at all these schools who have moved, Stanford and Cal to the ACC, USC, UCLA to the Big Ten, Oregon, Washington to the Big Ten, Washington State, Oregon State, kind of stuck in no man's land, all these different landscapes that these universities now have to navigate. This might be the biggest one, the hardest one for Kate Pay, as you wonder what the future of Stanford looks like, trying not to be pessimistic. You wonder, can they get back to the heights that they reached under Tara Vanderveer? Even if everything stayed the same, the Pac-12 is still intact. They're not traveling to the East Coast twice a month. It's a seismic hole to fill, and it's awfully hard. So congrats to Coach Vanderveer on a well-deserved retirement, 38 years, over 1,200 wins, 3 national championships, a legend in the sport that will be impossible to replace, and the highest compliment you could possibly pay her, the women's game, wouldn't be where it is today without her.